In the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land, and a man of Bethlehem in Judah went to sojourn in the country of Moab, he and his wife and his two sons. The name of the man was Elimelech, and the name of his wife Naomi, and the names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. They were Ephrathites from Bethlehem in Judah. They went into the country of Moab and remained there. But Elimelech, the husband of Naomi, died, and she was left with her two sons. These took Moabite wives. The name of the one was Orpah, and the name of the other, Ruth. They lived there about 10 years, and both Mahlon and Chilion died, so that the woman was left without her two sons and her husband. Then she arose with her daughters-in-law to return from the country of Moab, for she had heard in the fields of Moab that the Lord had visited his people and given them food. So she set out from the place where she was with her two daughters-in-law, and they went on the way to return to the land of Judah. But Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, "Go, return each of you to her mother's house. May the Lord deal kindly with you, as you have dealt with the dead and with me. The Lord grant that you may find rest, each of you in the house of her husband." Then she kissed them, and they lifted up their voices and wept. And they said to her, "No, we will return with you to your people." But Naomi said, "Turn back, my daughters, why will you go with me? Have I yet sons in my womb that they may become your husbands? Turn back, my daughters. Go your way, for I am too old to have a husband. If I should say I have hope, even if I should have a husband this night and should bear sons, would you therefore wait till they were grown? Would you therefore refrain from marrying? No, my daughters, for it is exceedingly bitter to me for your sake that the hand of the Lord has gone out against me." Then they lifted up their voices and wept again. And Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung to her. And she said, "See, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her gods. Return after your sister-in-law." But Ruth said, "Do not urge me to leave you or to return from following you. For where you go, I will go, and where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord do so to me, and more also, if anything but death parts me from you." And when Naomi saw that she was determined to go with her, she said no more. So the two of them went on until they came to Bethlehem. And when they came to Bethlehem, the whole town was stirred because of them. And the women said, "Is this Naomi?" She said to them, "Do not call me Naomi. Call me Mara, for the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. I went away full, and the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi when the Lord has testified against me and the Almighty has brought calamity upon me?" So Naomi returned, and Ruth the Moabite, her daughter-in-law, with her, who returned from the country of Moab. And they came to Bethlehem at the beginning of barley harvest.
Well, we're starting a new series today looking at something that has been called one of the finest short stories in all of literature, the book of Ruth, a clip from which that we just heard there. This is just a stunning story. There are unexpected twists at every stage. And as I so often say, this may be a very familiar story to you, but if it is, try as we go through this over the next few weeks to see it with new eyes, because there is so much more to this story than we may previously have realized. It's a story that is over 3,000 years old and yet has so much to say about our own lives today, about suffering, about loneliness, about value, about living in an alien culture, about death, priorities, loyalty, faith, what it is to be a woman or a man, about rights, about taking risks, about family, marriage, sex. It's all in here. And it's not only about us, but it's also about God, even though God has no speaking part in this story. And not only that, but it's about Jesus, even though it was written 1,000 years before him. Now, I want to take some time to underline something here as we begin. It's something that we all need to understand, whether we're men or women. We sometimes hear people offer the opinion that God or the Bible are biased against women. Now, the fact that this story, the story of Ruth, centers around women and is told from the perspective of women is not an accident. Our Western culture today is moving towards a more enlightened and egalitarian view of women and men. But there are still plenty of examples to be found of women being discriminated against. Now, the society of that day was a totally patriarchal society that unapologetically relegated women to second-class status. But against that backdrop, what we're going to see in this story is God affirming his love for his daughters in radical ways. And what's more, we're going to see God casting a vision of breathtaking proportions for how his kingdom is moving forward through the efforts of ordinary women. So let's just set the scene. Chapter 1 began, as we heard there, in the days when the judges ruled in Israel. Those were crazy days in Israel's history. Dark, dark days. At the time between Joshua, when the people entered the promised land, and the kings, King Saul and David and Solomon onwards. They were horrible times where the people of Israel were constantly turning their backs on God, worshipping idols, being oppressed by the nations around them. And it's full of graphically violent accounts in the book of Judges, of people being murdered, being assassinated. There's a woman cut into 12 pieces, as a general killed by somebody hammering a tent peg into his head. You know, this was just a crazy time. In the context of all that, a severe famine came upon the land. So a man from Bethlehem in Judah left his home and went to live in the country of Moab, which we know today as Jordan, taking his wife and two sons with him. Now, it's easy to skip over that verse without fully appreciating the horrors that it contains. We use phrases like, I'm starving, to mean we haven't eaten for 3 hours. Well, try and picture in your minds some of the images that we've all seen on the news of people in places like Somalia. People who have had to abandon their homes, their land, everything they had, to trudge barefoot for days over hot, dusty roads to reach a UNICEF refugee camp where they might get some food. And who knows how many friends and family lay in shallow graves back home or along the way. These are desperate times. Verse 2, the man's name was Elimelech, and his wife was Naomi. Their two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. They were Ephrathites from Bethlehem in the land of Judah. And when they reached Moab, they settled there. So let's just understand the cultural context here. Obviously, this is a story about Elimelech, Mahlon, and Chilion, because they're the men. And in that culture, that's who matters. If you're a woman, your identity is entirely wrapped up in your husband and your children. Then, verse 3, Elimelech died, and Naomi was left with her two sons. The two sons married Moabite women. One married a woman named Orpah, and the other a woman named Ruth. But about 10 years later, both Mahlon and Chilion died. This left Naomi alone without her two sons or her husband. I don't know if you've ever found yourself watching a film, and right at the beginning, the big name star of the film is shot, or drives off a cliff, or his spaceship blows up, something like that. And you think, is he dead? And then a minute later you realise, no, he can't be dead, he's still got the rest of the film to go. But that is exactly what has happened here. The obvious star of the story, the three stars of the story, are dead. In verse 3. And who's left? A woman with no sons and her two daughters-in-law, who are also widows, who are childless, and as far as Israel is concerned, are foreigners. We struggle to comprehend the destitution facing these three women. We started this morning by singing a very upbeat song of praise to God. We've spent some time thanking God for things in our prayers. We read verses that say things like, rejoice always. And all those things are right and proper. But it's very easy to move from that to the point where we're saying, we've always got to be happy. Things aren't supposed to be difficult or painful or worrying for Christians. Christians are great pretenders. We hit difficult times and we try to cover things up. For the sake of the gospel, we don't want to let on that things aren't working out so well. We're afraid that if we admit we have problems or difficulties or doubts, then God's reputation is going to suffer. So we try to present an airbrushed version of ourselves as proof that the Christian life really works. Well, guess what? God won't play along with that kind of masquerade. His word tells us constantly that this world is fraught with perils and hardships. Eugene Peterson, who, as you may know, wrote the Message version of the Bible, says this: no literature is more realistic and honest in facing the harsh facts of life than the Bible. At no time is there the faintest suggestion that the life of faith exempts us from difficulties. On every page of the Bible, there is recognition that faith encounters troubles. The character in the Bible that we often think of when we talk about pain and suffering and doubt and ruined lives is Job. If you don't know the story of Job, you can look it up later. It's a story of a man who loses everything, and it's about how he deals with that in his relationship with God. But in Naomi, we have someone who in some ways out-Jobs Job. You know, the collapse of her world is spread out over years of heartache and tragedy. It is a relentless series of disasters, starting with the famine, and then she has to move away from her home and her country. She has to live as an outsider, an immigrant in an enemy country. She loses her husband. Her sons go on to marry Moabite women. Now, this is not good news. This is a disaster. They're foreigners. They are non-believers. The Moabites are a political enemy. The Moabites were pagan worshippers of a god that demanded child sacrifice. Mosaic law banned Moabites from the assembly of Yahweh's people to the 10th generation. For a believing Israelite mother, these women represented her worst fears. And then things go from bad to worse. 10 years pass and these daughters-in-law are unable to have children of their own. This is a culture where it is a woman's business to produce children. And in addition to the personal heartache for the women, this is a catastrophe for the family. Because the survival of Elimelech's line depended on the birth of at least one boy to carry on the family name. Something that in the ancient world was everything. So this is just year upon year upon year of suffering for Naomi. How many sleepless nights did she spend crying, praying, begging God to do something? Why doesn't God step in and help them? Why isn't God listening? And then finally, the unthinkable happens. The premature death of both of Naomi's sons. This is the end for the family. Naomi has no place in society, no income, no protection, no future. Christians go through difficult times, sometimes telling glowing stories of an overwhelming sense of God's presence, a nearness, a peace, a comfort that came just when they felt they couldn't go on. This was not one of those times. For Naomi, there was no spiritual renewal, no comfort from God. She is battered by what has happened, and she is brutally honest with God about her feelings. She doesn't doubt that Yahweh is God, and she even has some measure of hope that God will bless her daughters-in-law. But she has abandoned hope that God will bless her. This is Yahweh's fault. God has become her enemy. The Lord himself, she says, has raised his fist against me. And that's why she makes this comment about her name. Don't call me Naomi, she says, because Naomi means sweet or pleasant. Instead, call me Mara, which means bitter. Now, we're not going to try to understand why Naomi was put through all this pain. You can read commentaries and see all sorts of views on that. We're not thinking about that today. But there are two things that I do want us to see from all this. The first thing is that Naomi doesn't pretend with God or with the people around her. She doesn't try to apologize for God. She brings her frustrations and her pain and her doubts openly and honestly to God. Whatever else Naomi might believe or might have done, she knows that God is big enough to deal with her anger and her pain. One of the lies that has sometimes crept in to Christian life is the idea that you must never doubt, that having doubts or questioning God, having a crisis of faith, is somehow a sin. Look, that is nonsense. Doubt is a completely healthy part of faith. Somebody sent me a link to Vicky Beeching's blog recently, and there was this great quote in it. She says this: if someone has serious doubts in their Christian journey, it's often called a crisis of faith. Whereas it may actually be a moment of pushing beyond the veneer of what was formerly seen as true faith into something much deeper and more mature. I'm not saying that we should all start doubting everything, but I am saying that if we're really engaging with God in our everyday lives, we're going to encounter things that we don't understand, things that don't fit into our neat picture of God. Because very inconveniently, he won't be defined. He won't be boxed in. He won't be shrink-wrapped. We can say to God, hey God, I don't understand. I don't like this. This hurts. This doesn't make sense. And God will say, that's okay. I'm still God. I'm sovereign. I'm in control. God is bigger than our doubts. That's the first thing. I'll tell you the second thing in a minute, but let's first catch up with the story. Naomi hears that the famine is over back in Judah. Maybe she thinks if she heads back home to Bethlehem, she'll still be a widow, still be defenseless, still not have any future, but at least she'll be with her own people who might give her some food. So she sets off with Ruth and Orpah in tow. And once they've gone far enough to ensure that her daughters-in-law can't try to get her to change her mind about going, she tries to send them back to Moab. Just as Naomi has no future in Moab, she recognizes that Ruth and Orpah have no future in Judah. And so we see this really touching, emotional scene with Ruth and Orpah clinging to her, sobbing. And then eventually Orpah is persuaded and heads back. Now, is Orpah being shallow and mean and foolish? No, she's not. She's being entirely sensible. In fact, arguably, she is showing respect to Naomi by doing what she tells her to. At least in human terms, Orpah is doing the right thing. And then the spotlight falls on Ruth. What's she going to do? We read this passage and we don't quite appreciate just how critical this moment is. Heaven is holding its breath at this moment. Why? Well, if you don't know the story, I'm going to spoil it for you because you need to know what happens in order to understand just how important this moment is. This is kind of a look away now thing, except that I don't want you to look away. Ruth and Naomi are going to go back to Bethlehem. Ruth is going to meet a guy called Boaz, who turns out to be related to Naomi. And by Jewish law, a close relation of someone who's died can carry on the dead man's family line in their place. It's an idea called kinsman redeemer. And we'll look at that in a bit more detail in a few weeks. So Ruth marries Boaz. And despite all those years of not being able to have children, Ruth has a baby son. And his name is Obed. And Obed was the father of Jesse. And Jesse was the father of David, as in King David, as in the greatest king that Israel ever had, as in David, the great, 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 great grandfather of Jesus. So Ruth and Naomi are standing on the dusty road arguing. Look, Naomi said to her, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her gods. You should do the same. Why is heaven holding its breath? Because what Ruth does here is going to impact not only the whole of Jewish history, it's also going to directly impact God's plan for the redemption of the whole world. And so the second thing I want to say about Naomi is that she has discounted one thing. She has lost her home and her husband and her security and her hopes of children and all those things that we've seen. All she has left is this wretched foreign girl who can't even have children. But she has discounted the God of the impossible. Verse 16, but Ruth replied, don't ask me to leave you and turn back. Wherever you go, I will go. Wherever you live, I will live. Your people will be my people. Your God will be my God. Wherever you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord punish me severely if I allow anything but death to separate us. This is a total, unflinching, unconditional commitment from Ruth. She's effectively saying, I am not a Moabite anymore. I'm giving up all my claim to my past, to my heritage, to my family, to my gods. I'm an Israelite now. I'm going to follow Yahweh. Even if you die, I'm not going back. So Naomi returned from Moab, accompanied by her daughter-in-law Ruth, the young Moabite woman. They arrived in Bethlehem in late spring at the beginning of the barley harvest. Spring, the time of new life, of new beginnings, with all the hope of the harvest ahead. And we'll see what happens next week.